Welcome to question time. But before we start question time, I have an announcement to make. So please keep your noble silence. Because apparently there are some people who have been breaking the noble silence and have been chatting and have been disturbing others. So that could be really bad karma. They may just be about to have a powerful insight and you go chatting to them. Or they hear you chatting to somebody else and you could stop someone becoming enlightened. Ooh, that's terrible. So please, keep the noble silence. If you want to speak, then wait till the morning when you can do the chanting. And then you can exercise your mouth as much as you like. Or wait till question time and ask me a question. Or come to the interviews and you can talk. But outside of those times, and if you see someone else who's talking, instead of going to tell them to be quiet and break the noble silence yourself, see anyone who's talking, you can take one finger and put it in front of your mouth and go. To remind them. And if they try and talk to you, sometimes we feel that we're being unkind or rude not to say something back. So if someone talks to you and asks you a question, you can just put one finger in front of the mouth and go, to remind them. Of course, it's difficult because in the evenings we have people from outside coming in, and sometimes they come in, they're not on noble silence, and they're talking all the way in, and then after the talk, talking all the way out. They're not talking. So you have to, don't be hijacked by their talkativeness. You keep quiet. Because if you can't find, you keep the noble silence, you're nice and quiet, there's a good chance that your mind might be quiet. But if you can't keep your mouth quiet, what chance is there of getting your mind quiet? So, all those who've been talking, no more chance. All the chances have gone now. You have to be very, very quiet. And if I find any of you talking, I will give you 50 strokes of the cat. I can't be mean and nasty. But please, out of compassion, and out of respect for me, out of respect for the rules, be quiet. Okay, one thing I didn't talk about so far is the walking meditation. I'll just give a little bit of instructions here. When you're doing walking meditation, it's no different than the sitting meditation. You start off with present moment awareness. So you bring yourself to where you are, into the here and now. So you don't worry where you're walking to. You don't be concerned about where you're walking from. The meditation behind you, the meditation in front of you, you don't even care about. All you're concerned about is the step which is happening now. Present moment awareness. You're silent, you try not to have a commentary, not to start thinking about the Dhamma. Sometimes people can have a walking meditation, they can give a talk even longer than I talk. So, be quiet. So silence. And then you can put all of your mindfulness on the feet, just as they're walking. Just as you put your mindfulness on the breath, in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. You can do mindfulness of the feet, left foot moving, right foot moving, left foot moving, right foot moving. As you get deeper into the walking meditation, you can actually see the beginning of the left foot stepping, the middle, the end. See, it's a full flow of stepping. Just like you watch the beginning of an in-breath, right through to the end of an in-breath. When you take your balance after the left step is finished, you see the pause between the steps, just as you see the pause between the breaths, the in-breath and the out-breath. And then your right foot starts to move like the breath going out. You see the whole movement of the feet. And you focus your attention there and you get so still, so peaceful, so alert, and actually so happy. So you can see how the both meditations they work together. And you remember to start the walking meditation as soon as you stand up from your seat. So there should be no transition between the sitting and the walking, sitting and the walking. If you want to know how long you should sit and how long you should walk, take it naturally. When you feel that the body now needs to get up from the seat, from the chair, and do walking meditation, then do that. Don't give yourself a time limit. I'm going to walk for 15 minutes or 15 hours. Just see what happens. And when you feel it's a time now to sit meditation, stop and sit. Keep it natural. Don't look at the clock. Don't be a prisoner of time. And that way the walking meditation gets very, very peaceful. If you want to do a little more interesting practice, if you're very dull when you're walking meditation, you can try doing the meditation on death, the insight into impermanence, while you're walking meditation. And how you do this, as your left foot moves, you note inside of yourself, you think, I will die. When the right foot moves, that's for sure. Left foot, I will die. Right foot, that's for sure. I will die. That's for sure. I will die. Try that. It's good fun. I will die. Left foot, right foot moves, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. You know what happens? You keep repeating that again and again. After a while, you come across fear. You all know that to be true on the surface, but you don't know it to be true deep inside of yourself. There's always a little bit of denial in there. And that's when you come across the fear, then you know, I will die, that's for sure, is working. And then you go through the fear, I will die, that's for sure, I will die, that's for sure. And you know you've gone through the fear when you really let go and detach. When you know you're going to die, why do you attach to anything? Why are you worried about your relations, your family, the people who have hurt you in the past, the people who will be waiting for you when you come out of here? Why do you even worry about that? You're going to die. Let go. Why are you worried about your finances? You're worried about your health. Why are you worried about the sickness in the body? You're going to die anyway. What's the big deal? Might as well get it over and done with. So I will die, that's for sure. It leads to a letting go, a very profound renunciation. So you go walking on that path and after a while there's nothing left. I will die, that's for sure. All my worries, all my fears, they will die as well. All my possessions will be separated from me. And you allow them to disappear and you're separated from them. You get so peaceful. That's insight leading to peace. I will die, that's for sure. So that's, in brief, how to do some walking meditation and how to do sitting meditation. Okay, now let's get into the questions this morning. Here we go, number one. During meditation, at times I see purple lights that move round and in and out of focus. This is before I start focusing on the breath. It feels nice to look at and rather comfortable. Should I focus on this light or should I start following my breath? Many thanks. Sometimes we can get some lights at the beginning of the meditation because they're moving around, they're not stable. If you actually focus on them, they won't last. You've got to build up energy and peace, first of all, before those lights will be able to remain with you. So my advice would be to go to the breath and get the breath so still and so peaceful and so beautiful. And then when the lights come up, it will be much more stable, it will be simpler, more brighter, full of energy. You have to actually practice actually holding a rough object before you can hold a finer object. So this way of meditation is actually a natural progress. You start with like looking at the body and not interfering with it. Then you start looking at the breath and not interfering with it. And then you may be able to watch the nimitta without interfering with it. But if you try and watch the nimitta straight away, you haven't got the ability, you haven't got the dexterity, the softness, the subtlety to really be able to hold it and allow it to do its purpose. So the advice is, if those lights come up at the beginning, say, thank you very much for coming, very nice, come later. Next question. How would I know that I am in jhanas? If you ask that question, you are not in a jhana. Because in the jhanas, you can't ask questions. The mind is so still and peaceful. So you know you're in jhanas. Where do you come out? Now the trouble is, because Ajahn Brahm talks about all these jhanas, And because I said they're really nice, they're really good, people want them so much. It's spiritual materialism. It's one of the dangers of me talking like this. It brings desire. And because of desire for these attainments, sometimes your perception manufactures them. You actually imagine them. And what happens? You come to me and you say, it's a jhana, isn't it? It's a jhana action. But please, it's a jhana. Please tell me it's a jhana. And I say, no. And then you go to another monk. And you go to the other monk or another nun. It's a jhana, isn't it? It's a jhana. And you keep going until you find one who says, well, maybe. Yes, it's confirmed. Be careful. It doesn't matter. What's most important is you get peaceful, you get blissful, you get still. So just make it peaceful. See how peaceful you can get. If you want to know, that book which I wrote about the jhanas, it's been translated into Chinese. So you can actually look upon that, look at that in Chinese, look upon it in English, and it gives all of the details of what is a jhana and what isn't. So you can do the checklist there. But one of the things you will know, if you can hear things, if you can feel your body, it's not a jhana. To be the jhana, the five senses have been so suppressed, you can't hear things, you can't feel things. Number two, most important, you're so powerfully mindful, you're not asleep, you're powerfully mindful, after you come out of the jhanas, wow, you're just full of energy. So much so that, I've seen so many people come out of the jhanas, and they just come out and they're just, ooh. They're just full of electricity. And they're just so powerfully still. Sometimes they can't speak to you. They look at you, you know exactly what's happened. They're so empowered. So still. So much energy, sometimes they don't know what to do with it. There's many signs of the jhanas. You're very, very sensitive. So, this is what happens after jhana. Power. But that is coming soon in a talk which I'm going to give tomorrow night. So I don't want to sort of take up time in one of the talks I'm going to give later. But now the next one. Question. During meditating, I often will reach a stage of nodding around. However, I am aware that I am nodding. Does this nodding refer to tiredness or refer to a process of meditation? It really depends. Is nodding when you're tired and is nodding or moving the body due to other things? Sometimes if it's tired, you know you're tired because afterwards you're so still a little bit dark. You haven't got the energy, you haven't got the brightness, the jolliness of the mind. Sometimes that's the only way you can know the difference when you start meditating between the stillness of dullness and the stillness of super mindfulness. By its effect afterwards. If you've got really good mindfulness and you're really still afterwards, you feel so bright and energetic. If it's like sleepy mindfulness, when you come out of it, you're still a bit dull and yucky. Okay, but there's another type of nodding, or another type of moving of the body, and that's just when, actually it's two more types. One is, you're not actually nodding at all, you're not moving, it's just the perception is playing games with you. And many times this happens. People come to me and they say, look, I'm sitting meditation, I'm quite peaceful, my body starts moving all over the place, it starts rocking. The first time that happened, I said, well, that's really strange, because it doesn't sound like you're dull. So the next time I opened my eyes when they were meditating, and I watched them and they were absolutely still. They weren't moving at all. And then afterwards they said, I was doing it again, I was rocking. I said, listen, I was watching you. You were absolutely still. If you don't believe me, next time I'll take a video recording of you. To prove, because you might think you're rocking, but it's just perception playing around. It gives you the idea that you're rocking, but actually you're very still. What's actually happening there is a part of meditation which I really like to explain, and I enjoy it sometimes. It's called, I just give it the word, perception gaining its wings. Because your perception is so conditioned, it's almost like you're a horse with blinkers. This is the way we've conditioned actually to see things, to look at things. From our education, our upbringing, our parents, even your monks. You look at things in one particular way. And when perception gets freedom, it becomes unconditioned, it starts to see things in strange and weird ways. You're still, but you can see yourself walking. And it's like one of the first times this happened to me. I was in our monastery in Thailand, and I went past the washing line, and there was this black towel on the line. And I couldn't. Who's using a black, jet black towel? And I looked at it. Am I seeing things? No, that was black. I stared at it for a couple of minutes. It was jet black. And then suddenly it turned back to white again. I thought, am I going crazy? Am I going mad? Now what's happening? Because I looked at it and it was black. And a second later, it was white. And it was supposed to be white. That was its proper colour. And all it was is my perception was having games with me. Sometimes you can meditate and you feel like you're expanding. Your body's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You don't hit the person sitting next to you. It's only just perceptions. Sometimes you feel like you're rising in the air. It's great you can have all these perceptions. In the Buddhist text, he said that this is one of the tricks which people with samadhi can do. They can change the perception of darkness into light. So at night time, it's as if it's daytime. At daytime, it's as night time. You can play around with perceptions like that. It's almost like a little game. And it just actually shows just how the world out there is very malleable. We can take dark and make it light just by the way we look at it. The mind is a forerunner of all things. It's incredibly powerful. We can take pain and turn it into ultimate pleasure. Take pleasure and turn it into pain. Take sickness and turn it into health. Health into sickness. We can do whatever we want if you know how to manipulate perception. So this is actually what's happening. This is one of the first times when your perception is becoming a little bit weird. It's not going along the ordinary channels which you're used to. So your body is actually still, but it feels like it's moving. And the third type of nodding is when, I've mentioned this before, when sort of the body is getting relaxed and peaceful, the chi, the energies are moving in the body, and the chi wants the body to move, and so it does move. So you just leave it alone. There's some sort of healing going on, some sort of energy balance, some sort of unblocking your channels, so you just leave it. In any case, those are the three types of moving in the body. In all cases, you just leave it alone. Don't worry about it. So that's why it's not a problem. Next question, Dr. Ajahn Brahm. If pain on the body is too much, should I concentrate on the breath or on the pain? Thanks. If it's too much, then move. Have you heard about compassion? It's crazy sometimes. Because people, they just want to fight through pain. If you fight through pain, you become like a Hindu yogi, not a Buddhist monk. You know, one of the great monks of our tradition, Ajahn Mahabua. When I was a young monk, I went to stay with him. He's very, very tough. But when I stayed with him, he gave a talk one night. I could understand this perfectly in Thai. I actually saw a translation of it not so long ago. It must have been a very good talk, which others appreciated as well. But the story I remembered was that when he was a young monk with Ajahn Mun, this great Thai teacher, he had a malaria fever. Instead of resting, he forced himself to get up out of bed and to help with the chores of sweeping. He went against the pain and the tiredness. He was a very strong-minded monk and began sweeping. When Ajahn Mun saw that, he blasted him. He said, "You stupid monk." He said, "As a monk, as a Buddhist, we don't fight these things. We investigate them. You don't fight them, you investigate." He said, "You should have been up there in your bed investigating your sickness, not fighting it, not trying to overcome it, investigating it with compassion." And that was a powerful teaching because that went against the grain of that tradition which always says, fight with pain. It said, no, investigate it. So if you have pain in your meditation, you have to investigate it, not try and overcome it and get rid of it. It's a teacher. When we used to have these mosquitoes biting us in Thailand, hundreds of them, Ajahn Chah always told us to call that Ajahn Mosquito. The great Buddhist teachers called mosquitoes have come to give you some Dhamma, So don't try and teachers have come to give you some Dhamma. So don't try and brush them away. They're teachers. They're teaching you about, you know, just irritation and pain and letting go. So if you have pain, it's an ajahn. Ajahn pain has come to teach you Dhamma. So listen to it. However, if it gets to the point that becomes intolerable, then move compassionately. Because if you haven't got peace, you can't listen to the Dhamma. If all you're doing is being enduring because the pain is too much, you haven't got the possibility to understand it. So leave it alone. Or rather, change your posture very softly. When you're changing your posture because the pain is a bit too much, you can't really investigate it peacefully anymore. It's like pushing the pause button on your meditation. You just change your posture, change your legs, or move your back very gently, slowly, mindfully. And when you're in the new position, comfortable, then you take your finger off the pause button and you're back where you were just before you changed your posture. You don't lose any peace in your meditation. All you lose is the pain. And that's compassion. Please remember that the Buddha spent 6 years before he was a Buddha working with pain. Not eating, standing still, all those ascetic practices he did for 6 years. And what did he learn from that? The only thing he learned from that is never to do such stupid things again. It was called Atagiramatanu Yoga, which literally means like practices which tire you, which take away all your energy. And that's called working too much with pain. So the best thing is actually to sit on a chair. Make it comfortable. Even the Buddha collected grass before he sat under the Bodhi tree. He made it comfortable without being too indulgent. So that's what to do with pain. If at all possible, get a mat under your legs, get a cushion, whatever it is, to get yourself nice and comfortable. Don't sit too long. I remember one of my fellow monks, he's the abbot of one of our monasteries, when he was young, he decided to sit through pain. His knees were really aching. He said, right, this is it. I'm going to sit through it. He needed 2 knee operations afterwards. That's stupid. So don't do that. You've got enough pain anyway, without having to look for it. Next question. Since there are 2 types of meditation, samatha and vipassana, to enlightenment, how does Pure Land recitation help in attaining enlightenment? There is only one type of meditation, not samatha, not vipassana. I didn't tell this story, this is from the texts. This is a very good simile taught by the Buddha himself. It's in the Sanyutta Nikaya. It's about the king, the emperor, who had a son. He knew that one day the son would take over the empire. So he wanted to teach his son how to do the job of being an emperor. So there's so much you can do just in theory. The best way of learning is in practice, on the job training. So he decided to send his son, the prince, to one of the border regions and give his son full autonomy, full power over that region, which was part of his empire, so that he could learn by his mistakes. He went there with 5 of his friends. After a year or so, the head people of the villages, the townspeople, their representatives, sent a delegation to the emperor to complain. They said, your son, the prince, is not governing properly. All he's doing is having party after party, celebration after celebration. He's doing no work. It's the same that some of you might send your children to Perth to go to university, and it might be the first time your son or daughter has been away from home. And instead of studying, party, party, party. Now that's what he was doing. It's just young people, that's just what they do. The first time out of the palace, out of the father's command, they were messing around. So the emperor realized he had to send somebody to teach his son about the duties of being an emperor. It's not just all fun and games. You have to do the work of an emperor as well. So he got his wisest of ministers and said to the minister, please go to that kingdom and just instruct my son about the duties. And the wise minister said, sire, if you send me alone, I'm afraid your son won't listen to me. Can I please take along with me one of your fiercest of warriors, the battle-hardened general, one of the leaders of your army? I want to take him with me as well, because I think together with the seasoned general and with the wise minister, I think then we can teach your child how to run a kingdom. And the emperor said, yeah, great idea, off you go. So they went as a pair, the fierce general and the wise minister. When they got to that border kingdom, when they got to the capital city, when they went into the palace, sure enough, there was a big party going on. And when they tried to get into the room where the party was being held, they were stopped by the prince's five friends. They said, who are you? And said, this is the fierce general, this is the wise minister, we've come from the prince's father, the emperor, to instruct, you know, your prince. And the five friends says, shove off. This is not your kingdom. We don't care about the emperor. Our prince is ruler of this kingdom. Get lost. The five friends said to the wise minister. At which the fierce general got out his sword. And he flashed his sword in front of the noses of these five friends. And in a few flashes, those five friends had run away and disappeared. And so, the two of them, the fierce general and the wise minister, could actually go into the room where the party was being held. Of course, when they saw these two gatecrashers come in, everybody stopped. And the prince says, who are you? Get out. And the wise minister said, sire, I've come from your father, the emperor. I'm one of the wisest of his ministers, and I've come to teach you about your responsibilities. And he said, I don't care about my father and my responsibilities. He gave this kingdom to me. We're having a party. Get out of here. The prince would not listen to the wise minister. So once again, the fierce general got out his sword, and he grabbed the prince by the hair, put the sword to his throat, and said, I am one of the generals from your father's army. Listen to this minister. And with the sword to the young man's throat, the prince said, I'm listening, I'm listening. And with the general holding the sword to the prince's throat, keeping him absolutely still, the wise minister could actually teach the prince the duties and responsibilities. The prince heard, understood, and from that time on, he did the job of a viceroy in this kingdom. He also had his parties, but not so many, because a prince is allowed to enjoy himself, but he did the work. And he learned from that experience how to rule this small state, and eventually in good time he took over the whole empire and became a great emperor. Now that story was told by the Buddha. And the meaning of that story is this. The emperor, the Buddha said, was me, the Buddha. The prince was my disciples. He says, you go off to like look after your own kingdom, your mind and your body. But when you actually are left on your own, you have too many parties. You don't do your duties. So you need someone to teach you. So the Buddha sent his fierce general and wise minister. The fierce general was called Samatha. The wise minister was called Vipassana. They journeyed together to the center of your kingdom, your mind. Vipassana was not enough, because as soon as Vipassana came in, it met your five hindrances, your five friends. And wisdom was not enough to actually to dispel those five hindrances. So the general took out the sword of Samadhi, flashed it in front of the five hindrances, and the five hindrances, they just disappear very quickly. Which allows the wise minister to go right up to the prince, the citta, the mind. But even then, insight, wisdom cannot be good enough to teach your mind. You need samatha, holding it by the throat, as it were, to keep your mind absolutely still. And then it listens. And once holding the mind still with samatha, instructing it with insight, there you learn Dhamma. There you become enlightened. It doesn't mean you don't enjoy yourself anymore. In fact, you enjoy yourself even more. But you also do your duties. And then you become, take over the empire which the Buddha founded. You too become an arahat to be able to teach and serve in the world, as well as enjoying the bliss of your own mind. The simile of the Buddha about how insight and calm all work together. So what is Pure Land recitation? How can that help in attaining enlightenment? How that can that help in attaining enlightenment is give inspiration and joy and happiness. I've already mentioned it's from happiness that the mind becomes peaceful and concentrated. By repetition again and again, you have to have present moment awareness. You have silence except for the recitation. That's all you can hear. It's the recitation over and over again. It's like a mantra. It leads to samadhi. And quite naturally, the time should come, if you do this properly, where the recitation has done its job. And the words disappear as you go into a very peaceful, still state. Chanting, especially recitation, is one of the time-honored ways of getting into samadhi. Just like the Buddha chant, it stills the mind enough for you to get into samadhi. But obviously, that you all know that by doing Pure Land, you can't just do the chanting, you have to do charity, you have to do good karma, you have to keep precepts as well. That's part of it. And which means, and I'll mention this later on when I talk about the jhanas, that when you are doing this chanting, if you've got a foundation of good karma, if you've got a foundation of compassion, compassionate work, and also precepts, you find when you do become still, that nimitta, that mind which comes up, is absolutely brilliant and beautiful. It takes you into samadhi. From samadhi you see things as they truly are, you become enlightened. It's just starting the process, starting the ball rolling, which is the hard part. Once the ball is rolling, the process is started, it leads inexorably to nibbana. That's how it works. So any questions about that? Okay, the next question. Dear Ajahn, normally it is not difficult to detect greed and hatred when they arise. However, how to detect delusion, since we are all deluded in a certain degree? Thank you. Actually, it's not easy to see greed and hatred. You can see the gross forms of greed and hatred, but the refined forms are very difficult to see. And it's the refined forms, they're the ones which keep you getting reborn. Many people can give up sex and become celibate. Many people can actually not be interested in food or TVs. But how many of you can give up greed to your body and your senses? You are concerned with your body and its comfort. You are so concerned with seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, that you will not let them disappear. The sign that you are detached, you've given up greed, craving, grasping, for this body and its senses, is your ability to let it go, to put it down. And the only way you can test that you have the ability to let go of the five senses and the body is your ability to attain a jhana. What stands between you and the jhana is your attachment, your greed for the five sense world and the body. This is karma loka. It's a world of the five senses. It's a world of a body. When you've abandoned that greed, then there's nothing between you and jhana. Temporarily abandoning it, you get into jhanas. Fully abandoning it, you're an anagami, a non-returner. Same with ill will, hatred. Sometimes we think, you know what hatred when you get angry at somebody? But do you know the anger at yourself? And that is the most difficult thing to overcome. Most people in our world have got ill will towards themselves. It's called guilt. And it sometimes is very refined. You've done something you rather didn't, And because of that, you've got an inherent need to punish yourself. And I've mentioned this earlier. People hate themselves so much that they're willing to have themselves punished by going to a lower realm after they die. They think they deserve to go to hell. It's incredible just how deep that is inside your psychology. Self-hatred is deeper than you think. There was one nun who was staying at my monastery a couple of years ago, a Western nun. She started to get deep meditation. She's got the nimitta. She was about to enter a jhana. She couldn't go in. She saw what the problem was. She reported to me that even though the door to jhana was fully open to her, she wouldn't go in because she thought she did not deserve such happiness. It's a powerful insight she had. And it's a common problem. You're afraid of that happiness because you think you don't deserve it. It's called ill will. Each one of you deserve all the happiness in the world. You don't deserve the bliss of nibbana. You deserve the ecstasy of jhanas. You deserve it. It's your birthright. So don't be convinced by your mistakes and failures in life so far that you don't deserve it. You do. You deserve forgiveness. Every one of you deserves that. Doesn't matter what you've done. You've heard me say this yesterday. I give you forgiveness in the past, present and the future. So whatever you do, even in the future, you already have my forgiveness. I give you a blank check. You can do whatever you like and I will always be your friend. If you go and convert to Christianity, I will always be your friend. If you come along and torture me, I will still be your friend. I've already given you forgiveness no matter what you ever do. Isn't that wonderful? It gives you freedom. So can you give yourself that freedom? Isn't freedom what Nibbana is all about? The taste of freedom? Liberation? So, look into your ill will. It's more deep than you think. That's why you have got delusion. Whoever asked that question when they said it's not difficult to detect greed and hatred, that statement is deluded. It is difficult to detect. And it's the stuff you can't detect. That's the problem. So if you actually see the greed and the hatred, the desire and ill will, then your delusion is getting less and less. And how you overcome the delusion, when you start experiencing mindfulness, getting more and more powerful, you understand why you're deluded. Because you're not still enough, things go past too quickly. Now, I was deluded thinking I knew that hillside in my monastery. I had to slow down to realize how wrong I was. When you slow down, you see much more. And you are deluded in so many other respects. Thinking that you own your family. Every time you say, that's my mother, that's my father, that's my child. It is not your child. They came into this life from their previous life with their own karma that's got nothing to do with you. It's like rent a car. It's like rent a son, rent a daughter, that's all it is. They didn't belong to you beforehand. They won't belong to you afterwards. You just have them for a short time. So it's not your son, it's not your daughter's. But every time we delude and think, that's my son, that's my daughter. That's my wife, that's my husband. It's not, you share your lives for a while. And then there's always a parting, either death or divorce, one of the two. And it's your parents. They're not your father, your mother. In the previous life, they could have been your sister. They could have been your friend. They could have been your child. If you see many, many lives, how can you say that person's my mother? Or that's my father? When they've been a friend, a sister, a wife, a husband, who knows? So, delusion says it's mine. It's not even your body. Delusion said it's my body. That I am aching, that I am sick. It's just the body being sick, that's all. Where did your body come from? It just came from the earth. That's sometimes people ask you, they used to ask Ajahn Chah, where are you from? He said, my mother's womb. He said, my mother's womb. You put that down on the passport forms. Sort of point of origin, mother's womb. And is that saying, well, your body comes from? It's not your body. If it was your body, you can actually tell it what to do. You can tell it to sit still, body, and don't ache. So who does this body belong to? It belongs to nature. It's nature's body. And that should be very obvious to you. Because when it's nature wants it to get sick, it gets sick. Usually at the most inconvenient times. When nature says it's time to die, you die. Doesn't matter how you struggle and say, no, I don't want to go, I'm too young to die, I've got too much to do. All the struggle in the world won't help you, it just makes matters worse. When nature says, time's up, you might as well just do it peacefully. So this body doesn't belong to you, so why are you worried about it so much? Now this mind, does that belong to you? Are you the owner of your doer? Are you the owner of your will and choice? Ask any psychologist, especially into advertising, know that you're very easy to be manipulated. You're very prone to being brainwashed. Your will can be controlled very easily. And for the last 4 days, I have been controlling your will. I've been taking over your mind, literally. It's not yours. And it's actually, it's not my will's doing this, it's my teacher's will. It all comes from the Buddha. He's taking over your mind. What a wonderful thing to do. And are you the one which knows? Delusions say, yeah, it's me knowing this. It's me doing all of this. So it means that when you get good meditation, you feel, great, I can do it. When a terrible meditation, I'm hopeless. Both are utterly deluded. You are neither hopeless nor are you brilliant. You are nothing. There's no one there to praise or blame. So shut up, sit still, and just enjoy the journey. That's delusion. So it's great overcoming delusion. And I will give you more information on how delusion is overcome with the insights based on superpower mindfulness. Any questions on that one? Okay. Next question. If both samatha and vipassana meditation are the same and lead to enlightenment, then could one practice vipassana without samatha, as some Burmese tradition teachers teach? Then why are there two different sets of meditation objects for samatha, 40 objects, and vipassana, 4 dumb objects, meditation? Thank you. Okay. If you think you're doing samatha meditation, then you will do vipassana at the same time. You may be sold a package of samatha, but vipassana is right inside. If you are doing vipassana meditation, if that's the package you've bought, then samatha is right inside. Every model comes with samatha and vipassana as a standard feature. It's not optional extras, it's standard. Then why are there two different sets of meditation objects for samatha, 40 objects, and vipassana, 4 dumb objects? They're not. It's all the same. Look, let's take the one you're doing now. One of the 40 meditation objects is Anapanasati. Meditation on the breath. What the 4 dumb objects meant here by vipassana? It's the 4 satipatthanas of the body, feelings, jitta, mind, and mental objects, or dhammas. Now, I've mentioned this already, it's in black and white, one of the famous sayings of the Buddha, repeated several times, any meditator who fulfills Anapanasati, who does that meditation object, fulfills the 4 Satipatthanas. It's in the Anapanasati Sutta. Read it for yourself, it's number 118 of Majjhima Nikaya, Anapanasati Sutta. You see it there, black and white, the teaching of the Buddha. It's not just in the Theravada, it's in the Agamas, the Chinese recension, the Mahayana teachings of the Buddha. If you do Anapanasati, at the same time you're doing the 4 Satipatthanas. That's the teaching of the Buddha, not a Burmese monk, not Ajahn Brahm, not this monk, that monk, the teacher of the great monk, the Buddha himself. I make mistakes, other monks make mistakes, the Buddha never makes mistakes. So go to the source, go to the origin. You see there, if you do Anapanasati, you fulfill the four Satipatthanas. The Buddha says that. You can see it in the Anapanasati Sutta. So, that's one of the meditation objects, which is the same as Vipassana. It is in both the 40 objects of meditation and the Satipatthana. In other words, there's no difference there. It just transcends. They join together. They combine. They're the same. It's just two different ways of looking at the same thing. If you don't believe me, if anyone likes to find me a copy of... Is there a library here in this temple? I don't know if there's a library here. If there is a library here, they may have some of the English translations of the Middle Lake sayings. You can get it out and read it to everybody. It's right there, Majjhima Nikaya Sutta 118. Check it out for yourself. And all the other meditation objects which I have there, like the four Brahmaviharas, loving kindness, that will also fulfill the Satipatthanas as well. Loving kindness is a valid way which leads all the way to enlightenment, says the Buddha. Liberation through compassion. So you can do it that way if you want. And at that time you're still doing the Satipatthana, you're still doing insight practice as well. They always go together. You cannot separate them. Any questions on that? Next question. Dear Ajahn, we have been focusing on the mind. What about the soul and the spirit? Can you please share your thoughts and your views? Thank you. Now, if you go deep, you'll find out what this word soul means and what spirit means. I've also actually mentioned actually where spirit comes from, the actual word. The English word comes from inspiration or respiration. It's like respiriting the body, literally. Inspiration means giving energy to the spirit. Being spirited means actually, you know, being full of passion or compassion. Spirituality. So it all comes, it's just these words we use in English, which means something in the middle of you, your essence. And when we have this idea of soul, this is a word which people have used for a long time, who actually recognize that when you die, it's not just a nothingness happens afterwards. It's something which goes across from life to life. Now the thing is, you can call that a soul. I don't mind people calling it a soul as long as they realize that soul is in constant change. It's a changing soul. The problem is that some people, because of delusion, because they don't see clearly, because they haven't investigated it, think that actually the soul is an entity which never changes, which is always the same from time to time. And that's the only difference between, say, Christianity. Well, actually, it's actually modern Christianity, not original Christianity. They have the idea of only two lives, this life and heaven or hell, and that's all. So, early Christianity had reincarnation exactly the same as Buddhism. All the Greek philosophers, they all believed in reincarnation. From Plato to Socrates, Heraclitus, Pythagoras, they were all into reincarnation. They wrote about it. And that tradition carried on into early Christianity. And there was actually, I think, the Nicene Council under Constantine, about third century, I think, that they decided not to have reincarnation anymore. But many scholars look at the original Bible, they look at the other texts of the time and say, that was an anomaly. Early Christianity had reincarnation just like anybody else. And many Christians remember their previous births, for goodness sake. So, you know, they know they've been reborn before. So reincarnation is part of things. So the only difference between Christianity, Hinduism and Buddhism is that they all recognize that there's a flow from one life to the next. In the Christianity and Hinduism, they think of that as a soul. And actually, it appears to the observer, the uninitiated observer, when you die, that you're carrying on. It feels like you. It has all of the signs that that's you carrying on. But just in the same way that it seems to be you who started this retreat, who was here on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and today's now day, that it's the same person, but it has changed. Sometimes we don't see the change, but it has changed. When we actually see the changing nature of this soul, then we have what the Buddha called the stream of consciousness. And that's what anatta means. No self doesn't mean no thing. There is this movement we call the movement of nama rupa and consciousness, of mind and body, always changing. And that, you can, if you don't look carefully, you think that's a soul. But in effect, in truth, it's completely changing from one moment to the next. It's a process, not a thing. Okay. Maybe I'll get into that later on when I... Am I talking about... Yeah. Life is... No one at home, anatta. I'll talk about that in depth then. But is there any questions or comments about that for the time being? Okay, next question. Venerable Ajahn, I have heard some people going crazy while practicing meditation. Maybe they use the wrong method or attach to the happenings during meditation. Please guide me how to overcome this fear. Thank you. Actually, there's more people who have gone crazy when they're not meditating than when they're meditating. That's like somebody saying, I've heard that people die when they're in bed asleep. Most people die in bed. That's a fact. Does that make you afraid to go to bed at night? Of course not. It has nothing to do with it. More people go crazy when they're not meditating. So that particular fear, I know that some of these evangelicals say that, oh, don't meditate. If you meditate, the devil will come in. And that's not true. If you meditate, the Buddha will come in, and the Buddha is not the devil. Wisdom, compassion, kindness, peace, problems get solved in meditation. The chances of you going crazy in meditation are just so small, there's more likelihood that you would trip over and hit your head and die because, you know, actually there's more chance of getting kicked to death by a duck than by than actually getting crazy in meditation. So, but what happens with some people have got schizophrenic tendencies. They hear sounds and stuff. And so such people that when you get into deep meditation, the sounds which you hear get even stronger, the nibbidas get more vivid. And it's those people who have trouble with meditation. Well, you can usually check them out pretty quickly. And all you need to do is just stop them before they get too deep. They don't really go crazy, it's just for a little while, so that they're a bit out of things. But they get back together again afterwards. It's no big trouble. But you don't go crazy while you're meditating. You go crazy when you're not meditating. So don't have any fear. I have been teaching meditation for years. I have no casualties yet. And I don't intend to start having casualties. Next question. A friend who had been meditating had these experiences. One, he had seen his deceased grandfather. I advised him to share merits with his grandfather after meritorious deeds by picturing him, telling him that he is sharing merits with him, wishing him happiness, and asking him to be reborn in a better state. This is a good way. Yeah, it can be a good way, but sometimes it depends on what you see as your grandfather. If it's the beginning of a meditation, you can't really trust it. The beginning of meditation, it could be just imagination. If it's deeper into the meditation, or you're a really good meditator, then perhaps it might be true. But you check out, what does your grandfather look like? If he's happy, he's probably a deva come to say hello. You don't need to share merits with him, he's probably come to share merits with you. But if they come and they look very miserable and thin and unhappy, then share merits with them. You don't need to give money to a rich person. So that's what you do there. But if you do see them actually in deep meditation or in your dreams and they look sort of really thin and haggard and unhappy, that's a sign they need some merits from you. If they look really peaceful and bright, usually clothed in white, then you don't need to give merits to them. They're having a great time. They've just come to say hello. They're not asking for anything. They just want to give you their compassion. Number two, lately he had been followed by a dark being. I advise him to do the same. Could this being be his grandfather again, or is it another deceased relative or friend seeking merits? Dark beings. Now listen, if you can look at them, if you follow by a dark being, turn around and say hello. You don't need to be afraid of anything in life except fear itself. So whatever you're being chased by in life, always turn around and face it and ask what you want. And then you find out a lot of times dark being is only fear and it's not real. So if it is your grandfather again, they wouldn't be following behind you. They come and see you face to face like they did in life. Unless, you know, your grandfather's actually probably, this is actually probably the case that you'll be followed by the CIA. I don't know what the Malaysian Secret Service is. Maybe it's that. Maybe they're checking you out. No. Followed by a dark being. Just turn around, face that being, and just say hello. See what they want. If it is, it's very, very, very unlikely the being will be seeking merits from you. They usually come to temples and seek merits from the monks. Because we've got no merits to give. This is the bank where people actually draw out cash. This is the place we disperse merit. So they usually come places like this. So the chances are it's just fear, not really the real being. But anyway, you can always share merits. Any time it's always good. You can't go wrong with sharing merits. Three, as such, he'd stop meditating, fearing that this being will enter and possess him whilst meditating. Is this possible? No, you don't get possessed while you're meditating. You get dispossessed. Dispossessed of greed, hatred and delusion. Dispossessed of anger. Dispossessed of stupidity. Dispossessed of pain and fear. Dispossessed of guilt. This is letting go, dispossession, not possession. So again, I've been teaching meditation so long, never once has someone been possessed by a being during this meditation. Never once. Now listen, this happened to one of my students a long time ago. She was meditating at home. She was very still, and she heard this voice very clearly in her ear. And what the voice said took her out of her meditation immediately. The voice said, "I have come to take over your mind." Ah! She thought, "I've come to take over your mind." So she came to see me. Ah, it's the spirit was coming to take over my mind. I said, "Now listen. If someone was, say it's a burglar, if someone was coming to burgle your house and take all your possessions, would they knock on your door first of all and say, 'Madam, please excuse me, but I'm coming to rob your house tomorrow night'?" If it was a burglar, they'd just do it. They'd come in there and steal. So I said, look, if it was really a demon, they wouldn't give you any sort of indication, "I'm coming to take over," and they'd just come in and take it. If they could do that, which they can't anyway. So I said, listen, that is just fear. So forget it. No demon in their right mind would come and tell you what they're going to do. So it's just fear which creates those things. So as soon as she heard that, she started meditating again, no problem at all. So you cannot get a being enter and possess you during the meditation. If you want to go into trances, that's a completely different method. When you let some being possess your mind, you have to let go of all of your mindfulness and completely abandon sort of your mindfulness, your knowing. And even then, it's very difficult for actually beings to get in there. Sometimes it's almost if you give your permission. It's like house vacant sign, so that something can come in there. But it's very difficult to do that. Only a few people can do that. And you have to have absolutely no mindfulness whatsoever. Almost like being in a hypnotic trance, but even less than that. So it's very, very, very rare. As for you, it's impossible. Number two, because for bad beings to get into your mind, only bad beings want to play around like that. Now, no good beings would do that. That's not their place. It's not right. It's not correct. And any bad beings, they can't come close to monasteries like this, to temples like this. They can't even come in the door, in the gate. There's too much good energy in monasteries such as this, in temples such as this, that you are fully protected. You don't know how much force field it is around this place. bad spirits just can't come in. They can only stand outside the door, and sometimes that's what they do, to ask for merits. They can't come inside from outside. Because bad beings, this place is too powerful for them. They can't come. Bad beings, this place is too powerful for them. They can't come close. You know that story which I had before? It's about this time when one of my disciples, she was a Thai girl. She invited her mother, her elderly mother from Thailand, to stay in Perth. And her elderly mother had no one else to look after her. So, you know, it was like looking after your parents. So she invited her mother to Perth, looked after her. When her mother became sick, she went into hospital, and it looked like it might be her last illness. They wasn't sure, the doctors couldn't say. So this Thai girl went to see one of these mediums. One of these people who could leave their body, travel in the astral body, could actually find out, you know, whether her mother was going to live or die. So this Thai girl gave, it's only $20, $20 to this medium. And all the medium wanted to know, what's the name of your mother? What's the hospital? What's the ward? What's the room number? So I can find her. And I'll come back and tell you whether, you know, because look at her aura, whether her sickness is going to be terminal or whether she's going to recover. So I'm giving her the $20. The lady went into trance. She disappeared for about, well, went unconscious for about 20 minutes. When she came out of consciousness again, she immediately handed the $20 back to this Thai girl. And the Thai girl said, what are you giving it back to me for? And the medium said, look, I found that hospital, I found that ward, I found that room. But I couldn't go in. He said, I haven't seen this before in all my life as a medium. There was a force field around your mother. That's how she described it, as a Western medium. There was a force field around that mother, and I just could not penetrate it. I couldn't get close enough to check out to see whether your mother was going to live or die. I'm terribly sorry. That's why I'm giving this $20 back. I just couldn't do it. But by the way, well, who is your mother? Why has she got a force field like that? And this Thai girl said, oh, my mother's a Buddhist nun. She's been a Buddhist nun for about 20, 30 years. At which the medium just got so upset. Why didn't you tell me that beforehand? Because we can't get close, you know, to people like that. They've got too much power. That's just one story amongst many. When you've got that degree of power, you're keeping your precepts, you've done lots of merits, you're a meditator, you've got more power than these lower spirits. Heaps more power. They just can't come close to you. If you wanted to use that power, you can send them packing. Say, go! And they have to go. You're more powerful. That's why when monks are around, if they go in the house as ghosts, the ghosts get terrified. We've got far more power than ghosts. I remember years and years ago when I first went to Australia, this guy who was painting a wall, and he turned around to us and he says, my God, who are you? He was apparently a witch. And you know, he trained his mind in witchcraft. And he said, you guys just don't realize how much power you have. And he looked at the monk with me and he said, he's not got power, he's in trouble. Sure enough, and he didn't know the fellow, just walking down the street. He was about to disrobe. He picked him up straight away. But monks have power. And you've got that power because you've been meditating. So you don't have to worry about being possessed. My goodness, I've got to go through these questions quickly. It's 9:10, I've only gone through a couple. Najuman, thank you for your guidance on Nimitta this morning. I believe that Nimitta has now become my friend. Ah, lovely. Good friends. I'm not certain whether to follow this friend or to abandon it in order to continue my journey. Good friends are part of your journey. The Kalyanamitas. So hold your hand, hold the hand of your good friend Nimitta, and you'll be a lot of friends. You'll have wonderful times together. And Mrs. Nimitta will take you right into the jhana house and leave you there while the Buddha teaches you Dhamma. So, great. Make friends with your Nimitta. Don't abandon your Nimitta. When you found a good friend, stay with them forever. Ajahn Bhagwanso, cessation of feeling and perception, the highest attempt of the Buddha Arahats. Please correct my view if my view is not right or goes wrongly or a wrongly asked question. Before parinibbana, only mental feeling is ceased, since physical form of Buddha arahat still suffer, then perception, which is mental stage, logically should still remain. If so, please advise what exactly is the meaning of cessation of feeling and perception. After parinibbana, form both mental and physical, feeling and perception cease completely as self, therefore no more self-rebirth, end of all suffering. Though impermanent in nature, Buddha's relics as form still remain as thinking evidence. Buddha's non-self wisdom formation still remains as Dharma teaching that you, Sangha, are teaching us today. What that really means is the cessation of perception and feeling is the temporary cessation of mind. So when I say you're letting go of things in meditation, you are really letting go. You let go of all your possessions to come in here. You let go of your family, your work, to meditate. When you sit down, you let go of time. When you meditate further, you let go of the thinking. You let go of your body. You let go of your five senses. Until you've only got the mind left, and you let go of the will, which is half of the mind, to go into the deep meditations called the second jhana and above. You know what the difference between the second, third, fourth jhanas and the immaterial jhanas are? It's just you let go of the mind. Consciousness starts to fade away. Gets more and more refined. Just before the cessation of perception and feeling, you have this amazing state of neither perception nor non-perception. What the hell does that mean? I'll tell you what that means. Is what you're seeing is cessation, but you are seeing that cessation. Your object is no perception, but you're perceiving no perception. Therefore, it's not really non-perception, it's perception, but it's seen as non-perception. You understand? That's what it's like. You have to experience it to know. And it's just things are about to completely cease. And then they cease. The knower has stopped. When things disappear, which are not supposed to disappear, then you understand what impermanence is all about. Impermanence is not seeing the rise and fall like waves going up and down on an ocean. That's simple. Imagine you're watching the ocean. You see the waves go up, the waves go down. If you think that's rise and fall, it's wrong. That something is always there, the ocean going up and going down. There's still something permanent. Seeing rise and fall is when you're watching that ocean, the waves go up, the waves go down. And suddenly, unexpectedly, not only the whole ocean disappears, but also the land which contains that ocean completely vanishes from existence. Now that is shocking, because oceans are not supposed to just disappear like that. Or it's like you watch a television, and you see the programs come and go. You switch from channel to channel, to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, or feeling, or knowing channel, the six channels on your television station called the mind. Now you think that is quite obvious. Of course the channels keep switching over, and there's different programs on each channel. But then one day, you're watching your TV called your body and mind. And you see not just the channels flip over, you see the whole television set disappear. The whole thing has vanished. And that is not covered in the warranty. And that's really spooky, because it's not supposed to disappear like that. That's what delusion says anyway, it's not supposed to disappear. But it does. Even your mind disappears. That's like the ocean. And all the land which surrounds it has all gone. Nothing left. Now that is weird. So weird that anyone who has that experience of full cessation will emerge from that attainment either an anagami or an arahat. There's no other possibilities. The Dhamma there is just so obvious. It's like you've gone up on top of that mountain, very, very high, to the peak of the mountain. You have to see the view. It's all around you, every direction. If actually only go to the very top of the mountain, but just a little below the summit, instead of watching the view, it is a possibility you could be facing into the mountain and not see the view. But on the top of the mountain, in all directions, you have to see the view. There's no other possibility. insight has to happen. You just cannot miss it. What you see, there's no one here. Absolutely no one. Even the knower is not a self. Profoundly, deeply, you become a non-returner or an arahant. As a result of that experience. So cessation, that's what cessation is. When you come back from that experience, descend the mountain, then you have your mind and your body again. But it's true, the arahants understand what's going on, so their body has suffering, but the mind never suffers. It's just cause and effect, because there's nobody in there to hold on to the suffering anymore. It's all gone. Suffering is, but not the person who suffers. Ajahn Brahm, you mentioned about going into the center of the breath, the silence of pain. Does that mean focusing, zooming in on the breath? Would that not be the doer doing again, or is it the knower who would one know we are doing it correctly during the process? It's the doer which takes you away from the center. When you do something, you're not being peaceful, you're not settling down. Every time you scratch, you move your body. Every time you think, you move the mind. Every time you do something, you disturb the process. Shh. Say that to your mind. Shh. Be still. Even in Christianity, it's in one of the Psalms, be still and know that thou art God, it says. Now, it doesn't mean like the physical, you know, being creator. Actually, it is, actually, because you are the creator of the universe. The origin of the universe, the Buddha said, and its cessation lie within this fathom-long body and mind. So, when you go really still, shh, it's stopping the doing allows you to go inwards. Any doing, you move outwards. There's a word in Pali called the asavas. Sometimes it's called the taints or the cankers. It literally means the outflowings of the mind. And very often the Buddha said, like, the Four Noble Truths, it's like the asavas, the four asavas. They use them as almost alternatives. To know the asavas, the outflowings, its origin, its cessation, away to the origin of the asavas, which is the Eightfold Path again. Those outflowings of the mind, you can understand what that word means in your meditation. You're sitting there and it goes out to lunch. It goes out to your family. It goes out to the experience which you hope to have next. It goes out to the body. Anywhere but going inwards. That's the doer. Makes you go out. If you're at home and you don't do anything, you stay inside. If you want to do something, then you start moving around. Eventually you're out of the house. You're going doing something. But when you don't do anything, you stay where you are and you go deeper in. So, focusing in is not doing. If you try and do focusing in, you'll always go out. You'll never be able to focus in. If you leave things alone, you go in. I give a simile like this evening about that, about the thousand petal lotus. That's for this evening. You mentioned about... Oh, that's what this... Didn't I want already? Center the breath. Next one. How long does it take for the nimitta to turn from white to crystal or brilliant? There is no time when you're watching the nimitta. Let go of time. So there's only the present moment. When is the present moment? How can there be minutes or hours? All time is a measurement. You have to go off into the future or back into the past to make a measurement. In the present moment, there's no time at all. That's why you can go into meditation and be timeless, free from all the minutes and hours. That's wonderful. Hopefully you have those timeless meditations. You're sitting there, you don't know how long it's gone. 3 hours, 1 hour, 10 minutes, who cares? Because time is one of those disturbances of the mind. In the present moment, you're still. Which is why the more still you are, the more that time has no meaning. If you get into jhana and die while you're in jhana, you get born in one of these heaven realms, the jhana realms, where you last for many eons. Universes come and universes go, and you're still meditating. Isn't that wonderful? Being so still. Big bangs come, solar systems form, cataclysmic supernova, throw dust throughout the whole universe. The whole process of evolution comes and goes, and you're just sitting there absolutely still. And another one comes and you're still silent and peaceful, sitting in the depth of bliss, completely unaware of the passage of time, because you're only in one moment. The deep meditations last a long time. If you die, it lasts even longer. Your eons of existence. Was it the immaterial jhana realms? Something like 84,000 million eons or something? That's a long time. Yeah, one eon is pretty long. Imagine like 84,000, not million, sorry. 84,000 eons. It is so still. You don't move. Time has no meaning to you. So time is just a movement of the mind creates time. Actually, time is created by craving. That's the cause of time. Wanting. When you don't crave anything, the time disappears. So it doesn't matter how long it takes, it doesn't take a moment. Because it's all the moment there is for nimittas to develop. Ajahn Brahm, do people with little questions to ask after giving clear instructions have lesser doubt? Why some have nimittas coming very early even before the mind is tranquil enough? The best way to answer the questions is to shut up, be quiet, and find out all the answers in the stillness of the mind. Otherwise, that one question will lead to another question. It's all the mind is moving. That's why I hope. It's never fulfilled. I hope for the end of the retreat there are fewer and fewer and fewer questions. But anyway, it's good to ask questions. And why do some have nimittas coming very early, even before the mind is tranquil enough? Because as you develop in this meditation retreat more and more, your mind becomes stronger and stronger. The less you do, naturally, no matter if you think you are getting somewhere or you're not getting somewhere, you are getting somewhere. The five senses I compare to my left hand. The right hand is the mind. Usually the five senses are so strong, they overpower, they overwhelm the mind. As you're in this retreat, because you're doing less, the five senses have got not so much to look at, to think about. So the five senses are getting subdued. You're spending a lot of time with your eyes closed. Because you're not speaking, you're not listening to very much. Because you're staying still, the body is becoming tranquil. Those five senses are getting less and less and less. Your mind is getting more and more energized. And it comes to the point the mind is stronger than the five senses. And that's when you start to see nimittas. The mind becomes manifest. It sort of pokes its head above the wall, as it were, then pops down again. But it comes up more and more often. That's all it is. When you see those lights, you're beginning to see your mind. Next question. Eight precepts. Is it meant for the duration of the meditation retreat or every day of our lives, your eight precepts? It's up to you. It's meant for this moment, at least for this meditation retreat. If you can keep them every day of your life, well, fine, why not? But be careful, because if you're working, sometimes you do need a meal in the evening because you are tired, you need the energy. So, you can keep the eight precepts if you like. Later on, but if you can't keep the eight precepts, keep seven precepts. Or keep six precepts if you like. You know, give up the TV, give up this sort of high luxurious furnishings. It's much cheaper in your house when you've got simple furnishings. And also, you don't need a burglar alarm. Because if the burglar's going to a Buddhist house, think, oh my goodness, they haven't got this big plasma screen TV, because they keep the eight, they've got no TV at all, no DVD, no big furniture. Because they're keeping eight precepts, they've got no jewellery. What a waste of time it is burgling a Buddhist house. You should put a sign in your house, not just we don't keep expensive things in this house, just say, in this house a Buddhist keeping the eight precepts. It's a waste of your time stealing this. Go to a Christian house. Oh, and sorry about that. I should have said that. I apologise. You don't have to be afraid. By the burglars when you keep eight precepts. So yeah, if you can, be great. Next question. When I meditate, I realize that a hand or a leg of mine would jerk suddenly. I know what the jerk means. You explained it a couple of days ago. After about a minute or so after the jerk, I started seeing dull waves of color. Am I illusioning? Side. No, usually because you start to relax, the mind is peaceful, the body is peaceful when you get those jerks. And it means that you're getting still. If you start to see colour, it's the start of nimittas. Not real strong nimittas yet, but it's the start. You're not hallucinating. What you saw was real. Next question. Sometimes in my meditation I can see a point appearing in front of me with my eyes closed. What does it mean? Should I hold on to it or should I let it go? There is such a thing called the point nimittas, the lights in the mind, but they're very weak, they're a long way away. So it's best to go back to the breath and build up energy of peacefulness, build up more tranquility before you allow the mind to go into those point lights. Why do people see ghosts? Is it because their energy level is too low? Are good meditators more prone to seeing ghosts since they have sharpened senses? Please enlighten us. Thank you. Now, I better be careful here because people in Malaysia, especially Chinese people, are so afraid of ghosts. If I tell you that the more you meditate, the more likely it is you'll see ghosts, maybe you'll give up meditating. But the point is, you'll only see ghosts if you want to, when it gets down to it. And most of the ghosts you see are just your relations, close people who are close to you. And the reason you can see them is because your mind is basically on the same frequency. Because you've been around them for a long time, because you've got empathy with your relations, it's called love, it's called concern, basically you're on the same frequency as they are. Which is why if there's a relation of yours, a close relation, who has an accident in New York, you know it in Malaysia straight away. You feel there's something wrong. And later on they give you a call or you get a letter that had an accident. You know it before it happens. Or know it before you're told, but you know it as it happens. And that is very, very common. When I was last in Melbourne, there was the story in the newspaper which someone cut out to give to me. A vet, a doctor of veterinary science in Melbourne, had left the clinic on a Friday afternoon. They were going to a party for the weekend in the countryside. He was travelling in his car alone, halfway along the journey. He was overcome by this amazing strong emotion. He couldn't understand why. It was completely out of character. It was so strong he had to stop the car, park by the side of the road, and weep. He just cried his eyes out. He didn't know why. You know, he was a man who never did that before. And he was just so emotionally distraught, he couldn't drive. He waited until it subsided, dried his eyes, and with a lot of effort, got back into the car and started driving very carefully at first, and managed to get to the destination. When he got to the destination, there was a message waiting for him. His dog, his pet, had been killed by a car. At exactly the same moment, he had that wave of emotion. 100 kilometers apart, he knew when his pet dog, which he loved dearly, had died. He didn't know exactly what had happened, but he felt so sad. Incredibly sad, he couldn't drive the car. He had to stop and weep. That's one story amongst many which happens. You may have had those experiences. So if there's a person which is close to you, like a father, a mother, a wife, husband, daughter, whatever, very often you feel them, you hear them, or sometimes you may see them, simply because you're on the same frequency. And you may be in that room and no one else will see them, but you will see them. No one else will hear them, but you will hear them. Because you're close to them. If you really get into deep meditation, you want to see lots of ghosts, you can do. But one of the things I will tell you, if you see ghosts, you'll have much more compassion to them. They've got a very bad press, ghosts. They really need a PR person to give them a better reputation. Okay, one last question. First of all, does every one of us need to attend the interview? No, only unenlightened people need to attend the interview. And also those who think they can benefit with some personal advice. So they're completely voluntary. You don't have to go to the interview if you don't want to. Secondly, is it a correct way if I notice both breathing in and out and the rising and falling at the same time? If it works, yeah. If it doesn't work, don't do it. In other words, experiment, innovate, find your own path. And lastly, it really helps a lot from the Q&A session as I progress a little bit more. However, is it appropriate to follow the mind and not control it, as my mind still does not develop much wisdom to not doing certain things? Okay? Experiment. But I tell you, the best way is just to leave it alone, not controlling it. If your mind isn't developing, you find you are controlling the mind. Your fingers are in there somewhere. But you know, sometimes you're not noticing, you're not mindful enough to see how you are manipulating behind the scenes. If you stop manipulating, stop doing things, you stop moving. And the mind gets very still. If it's not getting still, you are not following the instructions. You're still doing something. You're still wanting something. You're still expecting. You're not content. That's why it doesn't work. It's not because the instructions are wrong, it's because you are not following the instructions fully. Okay, so I'll have to stop there. There's still a few questions to go. Maybe I'll do one more and then we finish. A few, quite a lot. Ajahn, would you mind explaining how do we let go of my body during meditation? Many thanks. You let go of your body stage by stage. First of all, instead of letting go of the whole body immediately, you take one part of the body, focus on that, on the breath. And it's great not to put the breath on any part of your body, to do what I call disembodying the breath. So you know the breath's going in, you know the breath's going out, but you don't know where it's going in. So you have no feeling about your nose, no feeling in your stomach, you just know the breath. That's what I call disembodying, allowing more of the body to sort of disappear. If you're focusing on the nose never disappears. That's why sometimes people get tense around there. But if you just disembody the breath, you just know the breath is going in, know the breath is going out, you have more chance for your body to disappear. As you focus on the breath, like focusing on the eye of the bird, the rest of the bird's body disappears little by little. Until all you've got left is the head, and then all you've got left is the eyeball, the last part of the body that was the bird. The same way when you're meditating on the breath, your feet disappear, your legs disappear, your arm disappears, just like the body of the bird in that simile, which is why I gave that simile at the beginning. This is what's supposed to happen. And after a while, all the person is aware of when they're aiming at the eye of the bird is just that eyeball and nothing else. After a while in meditation, all you're aware of is just the breath. And the rest of the body, you just don't know what it's doing. And if I took a photo of you, or a video, you're absolutely still. You've got what's called tranquility of the body. The body's not moving. And it's wonderful to have that. Just so much worry and concern has been abandoned. You've just got the breath. That's just like the eyeball. And to get to fully let go of the body, you've got to let the eyeball disappear. You have to let the body, the breath disappear. When the breath disappears, you just let it go. Just stay with the breath. It gets more and more refined, more and more peaceful, more and more happy. And then the last thing which is left is the happiness, which turns into the experience of anicca. You're watching the mind then. At that point, you have let go of the body. At that point, you can't say, oh, where is my body? Because if you do that, the body comes back immediately. When a thing has disappeared, you don't know it's disappeared. In the same way, when you're watching the TV, you're not aware that the picture on the top has disappeared. You're not aware of it at all. The whole awareness has disappeared. If you start thinking about it, oh, is that picture on top of the television still there or not? Straight away, because you're paying attention to it, it comes back into your consciousness. So it's usually only after meditation you realize, hang on, I was just watching this nimitta and there was nothing else there. Only afterwards, when you reflect back, you know, yes, it had disappeared, the body had gone. After a while, you become familiar with those disappearing experiences. You know, they're so wonderful, you're not afraid of them at all. In fact, you welcome them. What a relief to let go of this very heavy, burdensome body. So that's what happens. That's how you let go of the body. And now hopefully you'll let go of my body to allow it to go to the interview room to answer questions from whoever wants to come. So hopefully you enjoyed those questions and those answers. And the ones which we haven't done, again, will be answered tomorrow, I promise. So happy meditating. See if you can go to the state of cessation in this next city. So you come out a non-returner or arahat. Wouldn't it be nice? So see how much you can stop. Everything. The red light has now appeared in front of you. stop. And there's a camera on this red light to catch anyone who goes through the red light. Stop. Don't do anything. Your car has to be still. Turn off your engine. Don't even idle the motor. Take the key out. Hand off the steering wheel. And park your body and mind here in Nibbana. Okay?